This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Groups are very resilient and innovative. So when one avenue of funding is cut off, they tend to kind of become creative.
That's Professor Vesna Markovic, a criminologist at Lewis University in Chicago, on how terror groups fund their operations. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa heads to Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Ethiopia. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Many African governments are struggling to contain terrorist groups who are finding willing recruits in poverty-stricken communities as the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic intensifies. Terrorism analysts say extremist organizations in Africa are keeping their operations going with financing that is hard to control. Most African countries, they say, do not have the technology and resources to implement measures and methods designed to prevent funds being channeled to terrorists. Darren Taylor reports.
Millions of Africans are spread across the world. Their need to get money quickly and easily to relatives back home has resulted in an explosion of digital money transfer networks. According to the World Bank, remittances to sub-Saharan Africa totaled about $50 billion in 2020. Financial experts, though, say this figure is much higher because it doesn't include money sent home via informal networks. Professor Vesna Markovic, a criminologist at Lewis University near Chicago, studies terror groups, particularly how they're financed. In Africa, she says, they collect money in a variety of ways.
Al-Shabaab also uses taxation of checkpoints, extortion, soliciting donations, for example, as well as external funding. In the Dusit D2 attacks in Kenya in 2019, they actually used M-Pesa to move money, for example.
M-Pesa is a money transfer service by Kenya's Safaricom mobile network operator. The attack on the Dusit D2 office and hotel complex in Nairobi left 27 people dead, including 5 Al-Shabaab jihadists. Markovic is also focusing on Boko Haram in Nigeria.
Boko Haram uses tactics such as extortion, taxation, bank robbery, looting of villages that they raid and plunder and take whatever they want. They've done cattle rustling, and these are just a few.
She says strategies to counter financing of terrorism, such as suspicious activity initiatives at banks, are now common in wealthier countries. In the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 attacks, she explains, any transactions of $10,000 or more would trigger American banks to issue suspicious activity reports.
Unfortunately, what terrorists started to do was they would just make transactions that were under $10,000. They lowered that threshold to $5,000, and the groups also subsequently lowered the amounts of money they were sending. So they would send $4,500.
So, says Markovic, it's very difficult for even rich countries who have financial intelligence units staffed by hundreds of experts to stem the flow of money to terrorist cells. She says some African countries are doing their best with limited resources.
In 2018, the Central Bank of Nigeria created a policy manual focused on anti-money laundering and countering financing of terrorism to include the Know Your Customer standards, focus on high-risk customers such as politically exposed persons.
Many African countries, even Somalia, says Markovic, now have anti-terrorism financing acts.
having all these wonderful pieces of legislation enacted are not going to be effective unless there is enough capacity for the legal system to be able to prosecute cases, to be able to stop these funds from coming in, and to be able to freeze assets and seize assets in order to prevent these terrorist acts from continuing.
She says Africa will continue to see a rise in terror attacks as long as the extremists' revenue streams flow.
Groups are very resilient and innovative. So when one avenue of funding is cut off, they tend to kind of become creative. And some of the groups, for example, during Corona, because a lot of things closed due to the global pandemic, have started collecting money and donations via Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And this
Markovitch says Africa urgently needs international assistance to provide its officials with training to better track money being moved by terrorists and political will from its own governments to strengthen justice systems. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Sudanese security forces fired tear gas at protesters today in Khartoum as they waved flags chanting for the return to civilian rule. Protesters were also out in force in Wadi Madani, a city in the south. In the capital's twin city of Omdurman, protesters burnt car tires and carried photos of people killed during demonstrations since the October 25 coup. According to the French news agency AFP, the military takeover in Sudan has triggered worldwide international condemnation and derailed a fragile transition to civilian rule following the April 2019 ouster of longtime autocrat President Omar al-Bashir. The U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa heads to Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Ethiopia today amid ongoing crisis in the two African nations. David Satterfield and Assistant Secretary of State Molly Fee will travel to Riyadh, Khartoum, and Addis Ababa today through Wednesday. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed the possibility of successfully resolving the conflicts as the two diplomats meet in Riyadh with the Friends of Sudan, a group calling for the restoration of the country's transitional government after a military coup in October. A State Department statement says the meeting aims to marshal international support for the UN mission to facilitate a renewed civilian-led transition to democracy in Sudan. The UN peacekeeping mission to Mali, or MINUSMA, said it has temporarily suspended all flights following West African and EU states' imposed sanctions that disrupted air and land transport. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako.
MINUSMA flights were abruptly grounded Sunday night in what an email to staff said was a temporary suspension. The email, reviewed by VOA, said MINUSMA has to temporarily suspend all flights and that staff would be informed as soon as the mission receives clearance from the government authorities to resume flights. Several regional airlines have suspended service to Mali due to sanctions imposed by the Economic Community of West African States that stopped air and land transport between countries in the regional bloc, known as ECOWAS, and Mali. After France backed the ECOWAS sanctions, which were imposed following a special summit in Accra, Ghana on January 9th, national carrier Air France also suspended service to Mali. MINUSMA normally operates flights within Mali in between Bamako and Mali's central and northern cities, where there are several MINUSMA bases. During a UN Security Council meeting on January 11th, Russia and China blocked UN support for the ECOWAS sanctions. A MINUSMA spokesperson was not immediately available for comment. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
The former president of Mali, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, has died. He was 76. Commonly known by his initials, IBK, Keita was deposed by the military almost 2 years ago. He took power in September 2013 and was re-elected to a second five-year term in 2018. It was during his presidency that Islamist insurgents overran large parts of the country, including the ancient city of Timbuktu. In 2020, tens of thousands of Malians took to the streets of the capital Bamako to demand his resignation. His death comes at a time of growing tension between Mali's ruling junta and the Economic Community of West African States, which imposed new sanctions on the country. Mali has also been at loggerheads with Paris over its decision to deploy the Russian mercenary outfit, the Wagner Group. Namibian authorities say thousands of Angolans who entered Namibia in the past year to escape drought back home have been returning amid fresh rains. Authorities this month said at least 18 Angolan infants whose parents fled hunger died in Namibia from malnutrition. Vitalio Angula reports from Windhoek.
The acting health director in the Omsati region of northern Namibia, Dr. Fratsina Ananias, said most of the Angolan migrants arrived in the country in terrible condition, leading to the deaths of several infants who had accompanied their parents in search of food and water.
We assessed them and we find out that they have malnutrition. So we have been giving them different formulas that we have so that they can pick up, but unfortunately some of them have died.
The governor of the Umsachi region, Erhunus Njala, who oversees the migrants' safe return to Angola, said the recent rains have encouraged them to return home in order to tend to their fields.
For the past 5 years, they did not receive enough rain. It means climate change have really brought severe drought to that part of Angola. That is now the southern part of Angola. And therefore, when they come, you could already see from the bodies that they were malnourished. And as a result, some of those kids could not survive due to the lack of food. And also their mothers, they don't have enough milk to breastfeed them. That is the reason I think we have recorded that higher number of infant mortality.
Local journalist Maria Davids spoke to some of the migrants who are being repatriated by the Namibian government to Angola.
The group were excited to return home, saying they were willing to restart over and be reunited with their family.
In Namibia and Angola, incidents of hunger, both rural and urban, are increasing. The COVID-19 pandemic, drought, and changing weather patterns are reversing gains made in terms of both countries realizing the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. The U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa heads to Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Ethiopia. And the former president of Mali, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, has died at age 76. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Zimbabwe has just received a financial boost from a German organization to help the country manage one of its largest national parks. Arigando has more from Bulawayo.
Following local media reports, VOA reached out to the Zimbabwe National Parks Authority to verify whether Gonarejo National Park, one of the country's biggest wildlife reserves, will receive US $1 million annually from a fund intended to assist the financially struggling entity with its operations. The money would be secured from the Legacy Landscapes Fund, a new global initiative that channels financial support for wildlife conservation endeavors in ailing economies. Reports say the money would support many activities, including the fight against poaching, the promotion of ranger patrols, and the maintenance of equipment. The country's second largest park extends 5,000 square kilometers and carries close to 11,000 elephants. Park spokesman Tinashe Farao confirms the news.
Yes, the story is true, but I'm sure you need to understand we are jointly managing that park with Frankfurt Zoological Society.
The National Parks Authority is cash-strapped and has been advocating the trade in ivory and elephants, citing growing operational costs and the burgeoning number of animals in the country. Parks officials also cite human-wildlife conflict as one of the reasons their population needs culling. Luke Brown is a conservationist with the Zambezia Conservation Alliance. He's among those who see the new partnership as a welcome development, considering the growing cost of managing wildlife and the natural environment.
Conservation is not cheap, and any funding like this to further the preservation of Africa's fauna and flora is always welcome.
Brown's organization supports frontline efforts in marginal areas alongside parks like Gonarejo, where human-wildlife conflict is prevalent. He says collaboration is one of the ways of mitigating rising costs.
We encourage others to step up to the mark in assisting national parks and private conservation organizations in a coordinated effort to combat illegal wildlife trade and maintain and improve the biodiversity of our precious natural resources.
Zimpax has in the past deplored the fact that despite global outrage about trade in elephants and their tusks, national parks, communities, and conservation organizations alike lack sustainable long-term funding. Observers say that maintaining wildlife preserves and preventing animals and vegetation from extinction in countries with struggling economies such as Zimbabwe requires a sustained approach to funding. Zimbabwe parks officials say with satisfaction that the new deal with the German-based Zoological Society does just that. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The Zimbabwe government is working on introducing the private voluntary amendment bill to guard against money laundering and terrorism, but critics worry the proposal will be used to restrict non-profit organizations. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has the details.
Political analyst Clarice Maduku says the bill has no place in a democracy.
The PVO amendment is one of those draconian laws in Zimbabwe that will have a very negative impact on the operations of the civil society in Zimbabwe. In fact, the context under which the PVO amendment is being made shows clearly the attitude of the Zimbabwean government towards the civil society in terms of how it has carried its mandate in questioning and critiquing the work that the government has done.
The bill also seeks to stop non-profit organizations from interfering in politics. Critics have stressed that such a justification is broad, as most work by non-profits can be regarded as political. Add to this, the bill gives the regulating minister powers to ban or suspend non-profit organizations' board members and top management and appoint their own while they investigate the organization. Daniel Chigudu is the editor of Open Parli, a publication that covers parliament business and political developments in Zimbabwe. He gives an update on the status of the bill.
After it is introduced in the National Assembly, they need to go for the public hearings. Parliament is adjourned to February. The responsible committees had actually published their itinerary for the public hearings, but because of COVID-19, the cases were going up, especially at Parliament. They had to cancel and shelve the plans.
Dzikama Ibere is the director of a local non-profit organization called Zim Rights.
So we are living in a country where the government has failed to provide human security, food security, basic rights access to education, protection of women and girls. And this is work that is being done by PVOs. So we are living in a country where the government has failed to provide human security, food security, basic rights access to education, protection of women and girls. And this is work that is being done by PVOs.
In male-dominated societies like Burkina Faso, wives are most often blamed when marriages run into trouble. But a project funded by the World Bank is testing the concept of teaching men how to be better husbands by taking them to school. Henry Wilkins reports from Yako, Burkina Faso.
The path to a successful marriage is not always an easy one, but an initiative set up in Burkina Faso by the Sahel Women's Empowerment and Demographic Dividend, SWED, aims to make it less difficult. Yeli Owigo, who is married to Kwame Zupoka, attended so-called husband schools organized by SWED to help him become a better spouse. Before taking part in the classes, life as a couple wasn't easy, says Owigo. He says he once didn't think that women and men had much in common when it comes to problems with family life. But after the classes, he understood they can complement and help each other. Burkina Faso is a male-dominated society, but the schools use a variety of teaching techniques, including role plays, to help the men understand the needs of their wives and how to meet them. For example, helping with housework. They also teach the men about women's rights, family planning, health and hygiene, and the men are encouraged to include women in making family decisions too. The coordinator of the project in this area of Burkina Faso, Nabalu Bibata, says the classes have made a big difference to women in the community. She says there are even men who have attended the childbirth of their wives, which is part of assuming responsibility for the care of the children by the men. She says for the men of the village who weren't able to participate in the husband schools, those who did have become role models. Although these are the first schools of their kind in Burkina Faso, similar projects have already been implemented in countries like South Africa and Niger. Edward Wageni is global head for the UN Women He for She initiative. He says the school can help reduce incidents of domestic violence. And they are also about
the acknowledgement that gender equality is not just about women and girls. Gender equality is about everybody,
including men and boys. Asked if husband schools could be beneficial in countries outside Africa, where statistically gender equality is better than Burkina Faso, Wageni replied,
"So this is a good idea that can be replicated and even scaled up in other parts of the world, including those countries that feel that they have made a lot of gains."
Zupoka, meanwhile, says the classes have made her husband much more helpful and considerate. She says the love between her and her husband is growing. Now, when my husband goes to the markets, he brings me little gifts, something he didn't do before, she says. So, she says, she is very, very satisfied. The national coordinator of the Husband Schools project says it's been a resounding success and is going to be expanded to other parts of the country. The second phase of the project is due to start later this year. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Yako, Burkina Faso.
Equatorial Guinea pulled one of the biggest upsets in the history of the Africa Cup of Nations yesterday, beating defending champion Algeria 1-0. Equatorial Guinea's heroics yesterday in Douala has shaken the tournament. Few would have expected Algeria, unbeaten since October 2018, to go down to a country with a population of 1.4 million. Algeria has now been relegated to last place in Group E. At yesterday's matches, heavyweight contenders seem to have been caught off guard. Debutante Gambia rode its luck with a last-minute penalty to draw 1-1 with Mali in Group F. Sierra Leone, competing at the finals for the first time since 1996, had a 2-2 draw against powerhouse Ivory Coast. Only Tunisia ensured some normality yesterday as it destroyed Mauritania 4-0 to revive its hope in Group F. Today, Group A is decided with host Cameroon up against Cape Verde and Burkina Faso facing Ethiopia. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The the best music comes from Africa. And African Beat gives you the best of the best. From Benga to Juju, Hip Life to Bunga Flavor, Afrobeat to Ndombolo and Makossa to Kwaito. All happening right here on the African Beat of the Voice of America. Monday through Friday, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time. With me, your host, David Vandy.